is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Summer Brenner about her new book, My Life in Clothes. It's a collection of short stories, a small, relatively small book, only about 130 pages or so, of interlinked, or what I would call interlinked stories. How are you, Summer?
I'm fine, thank you, David.
It's really good to talk to you again.
Same here. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, sure. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the, you know, how this book came about and what clothes must mean to you or mean to your characters in this story, because obviously the clothing is what creates the theme, the running theme of the story. It's not that each one is the same as any other, but it's all about clothing and what it means. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think clothing means something even when you don't care about it. But I happen to be a person who actually does care about clothes. I think of it a bit the way I think about architecture, if you can imagine. It's kind of design and form, color, style for the individual body. So clothes have been a form of self-expression for me. Not my entire life. I would say I was kind of, maybe groomed to care about clothing when I was young in a way that was imposed on me from the outside, from the social milieu that I grew up in. But then I came to care about clothes in a way that, as I said, self-expression, but also that had a kind of sort of theatricality, that my interest in dance and kind of costume. And so clothes have meant a lot of different things to me.
Well, it seems almost like, you know, the clothing is a related to your being a writer as well. I mean, in other words, it's a form of self-expression, but it also, you know, becomes a way of telling something about yourself in an indirect way, and that's really what writing is about.
It is, and it's certainly it's a form of artistry. I mean, one might argue it's taken to a kind of extreme, and the whole commercialization of clothing is a, you know, I mean, it's a large topic that has, you know, deep histories in actually the roots of, maybe you would say, this country. When you think of the 19th century and the fact that you're producing all of this cotton that's going to go to all of these mills, you know, one from the south and the other in the north, and that, you know, these two aspects of, you know, that wealth is really founded on the fact that cloth is being made. And I believe the first denim was made for slaves.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think
denim. Now, I may have it wrong, but I thought denim was, it came about during the California Gold Rush.
Well, Levi's came about. The Levi family began to manufacture a kind of clothing out of denim that was used by the 49ers. But I believe that denim was actually used earlier in the 19th century as a typical clothing for slaves.
Indigo was the dye that mm-hmm. was used, the indigo mm-hmm. from the lowland Carolinas, probably.
That's right. Because you go into some of those beautiful Georgian 18th century towns in South Carolina in particular, and you find, you know, the Indigo Society engraved on the side of a building in town. So South Carolina, for example, I mean, the fortunes come through indigo rice, and then, you know, cotton is grown as well, but all through the South, cotton.
And of course, you're from the South, which
I am.
You're from the Southeast.
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and some of these stories take place in Atlanta, and some of them are rooted in family stories. I have had a mother and a grandmother and aunts and cousins, and everyone was paying attention to clothes. And girls at school were paying attention to clothes. I don't think that that's diminished so much. I think that girls are paying plenty of attention to clothes, but I also think it does depend on certain economic factors that are in the family, and whether going shopping or is something that you do out of necessity or that is done out of pleasure. And my mother had her clothes made, some of them, because there were certain fantasies that she had about clothing. And she was a very artistic woman. She came to be a painter in her 40s, and she painted fantastic paintings. If anyone is interested, I have a website under my name, summerbrenner.com, but I have my mother, Rita Brenner's paintings are available to see in a gallery on my website. I inherited about 45 paintings, and some of them I've hung, and some of them are hanging elsewhere. And she came to painting late, but she was a very, very serious artist.
And some of the stories seem very, I mean, they're told in first person, and it's kind of tempting to think of them as being autobiographical, and not necessarily literary, but literally autobiographical. But they do seem, they have that element of, you know, growing up, this is stuff that you knew really well. And these are people that you knew really well.
I say about the stories that some of them are true-ish.
Right.
And some of them are quite fictional. And then the way the stories are woven together, it's somewhat, the conceit of clothing is used somewhat obliquely. So some of the stories really are about, you know, a spring coat or a wallet or a pair of shoes. But other stories are, they may have a title that would suggest something about clothing or accessorizing or appearance, but it's a little bit more of an oblique reference.
Well, and of course, one of them, one of the stories I really liked a lot, and that's partially because I got to go to England in, you know, the early 60s. And you have the story about going to Harrods, Harrods, pointed out. And but the interesting part of the twist of that story is that the accessory is not necessarily clothing.
Yes, people really like this story.
It was kind of surprising, I have to say.
Yes, it actually borders on fact.
Well, it had that feel of authenticity.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I think I'm very sensitized to this notion that writing should not be read, fiction shouldn't be read as if it was some sort of coded nonfiction. But it's also interesting when stories like this seem to come so much from the, almost from your soul, you know, your experiential being gets carried along. And so it's hard, again, it's not like I'm trying to, you know, figure out which things are literally true and which things aren't, and it's not really even the point, but it's just because they feel so autobiographical, you know, that they're about a period when you were growing up, and they, you know, they move into later times with characters who recur, and they just feel, you know, kind of like they have that voice.
I think the temptation is really underscored because most of the stories are in first person.
Yeah.
And although the book is really about two characters, two cousins, the stories are predominantly about one of those cousins telling about her life and then commenting on her cousin's life as well. And since the book was published, you mentioned it's a slender volume, I've really thought of about almost like a dozen more stories that you know, if there were a new version, another version, another edition of that I would want to write and include.
Well,
it's just so funny. I mean, it's just seeing the book has kind of been such a catalyst for so many odd and sundry stories that would fit so beautifully in this collection. I like doing things thematically, and in 1990, Coffee House Press published a book of short stories of mine called Dancers in the Dance, and there are 12 stories about dancers. And again, some of them are literally about dancers, and some of them are only obliquely about dance in dancers. But dance has been a kind of a very important part of my life. And as I mentioned in the comment that I made about clothing being kind of an expression of sort of someone's a theatrical aspect, maybe, of my own personality, some of that got exercised through studying dance through one period of my life, and now again I'm studying it again in this period of my life.
So when you say studying dance, what does that mean exactly?
It means I go to dance class and I'm humbled.
Now, are you dancing?
I'm dancing in dance class, and I love to dance. So yeah, I dance socially, but this is, I mean, I'm in a dance class. You know, this is serious work, really. It's serious work. It's really fun, and it's a tremendous amount of. It's a reflection on discipline. It's a reflection on physicality, it's sensual, it's very camaraderie. There's a lot of camaraderie in this particular dance studio that I go to. It's very serious there, but it's very warm, so you feel like, you know, you're attempting to do something. You're attempting to do a pirouette. It's very difficult.
So if for you, when you write these stories, do you think of them, and especially now when you're looking at the collection and thinking about writing more stories, are you kind of thinking of it as an arc which, almost like a novel, tells a complete story?
I had a lot of stories. I have a collection, an unpublished collection of stories now, that actually have to me, they have a very strong thematic connection. These stories that became my life in clothes were stories, some were written really quite a long time ago. Some were really sketches, vignettes, you might call them, that were written less of a long time ago. Some of them were written quite recently. But when I was assembling what I thought could be a collection of stories, I began to kind of look for something that would give it a certain kind of cohesiveness. And clothing, actually, because one of the title story, the fact that that became the title, then became the inspiration to kind of shape and mold some of the stories that maybe were less about clothing, to kind of create something that they could also fit into this leitmotif that was running through what, you know, was potentially a collection. I didn't know that it was going to be published at that time, but I was looking for those, you know, the sort of sticky stuff that would pull the stories together in a somewhat loose fashion. I know that in one of the reviews they talked about a novel in story form. I don't think of the book that way, although because the book gives different time periods in different places, experiences to two different characters, and because the characters are reoccurring and the stories are not chronological, because so you kind of come to some conclusion and then you read on and then you read another story and maybe your conclusion is somewhat altered or colored slightly differently. I hope it's a complete experience. I think that's what people are saying when they say that.
Well, and the implication in the title is that as well.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
My life, it's a whole story then. You know, and life, a life does not necessarily have to have a, you know, constructed arc. You know, it life happens. So in a lot of ways, you know, it becomes a way of telling a story through a larger story through smaller vignettes. And I guess maybe that's what people are thinking when they say like a novel and stories.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe it's also the temptation is just to try to find a way of organizing the experience. I kind of like just reading them without thinking about that. But I thought, you know, definitely there is an arc of development in the two main characters as they grow and change over the years. And the theme of clothing and how they relate to it and how they relate to the world through clothes and, you know, who they are, their definitions of who they are, each change over time.
And yeah, well said.
Well, and so of the stories, you know, do you have particular, and I will say, I think the writing is really, really good throughout. You know, it's kind of, I wouldn't have thought, in fact, when you just said that you'd written these over a long period of time, the style feels pretty coherent and cohesive. So it's sort of surprising to hear you say that you wrote these over a long period of time. You know, they don't sound like, you know, one written years ago, another written more recently, where style changes over time. So, you know, I think your writing is really strong throughout. And as I noticed, one of the reviews, which was the big important one, I guess, is the one in The Economist, pointed out your prose is rhythmic. And I thought it's also, it's just very natural. You know, it's very clean prose. It doesn't try to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to
say
that.
I try to do more. But then when I edit, I take all those tries out. You know, it just
right.
looks so superfluous to me.
Right.
I read writers who have a way of elaborating, and I admire them so much. And then when I go for it and go back to it, it's kind of like, no, I can't. So you know, the interview that we did for the crime novel, I-5, I mean, that book is so spare. I mean, this book is, I think, less spare. But there is this kind of inclination to really only say what needs to be said in a very distilled way. The story collection that I mentioned that I've been writing over the last couple of years that is unpublished, the stories are very long and convoluted. So I'll be interested if sometime, you know, you'll read one, or perhaps if they're published that you'll read them, because I think it is a very different way of writing about, you know, writing fiction than the two books that you've interviewed me for. When I say that some of these stories were written a long time ago, like The Spring Coat, which happens to be one of my favorite stories, and it's about a girl's experience going off to Boston, and she's going to a girl's college in Boston, and she's having a transitional moment for her. She really is in outside her family home for the first time, as so many, of course, college students are, and she's thinking about herself in different ways, but she's still bearing the accoutrements of a well-to-do, well-raised, well-mannered girl, and she has an encounter in Boston on the MTA, and it really has to do with class as perceived through clothing. And that story, it was published in a small magazine some decades ago. I mean, at least two decades ago. So when I say that some of these stories were written a long time ago, I seriously mean that. But because I'm such a constant editor, I think that even if the style of the story was somewhat different, or it was more, you know, it was, I was a less mature writer. That goes without saying, if the story was written at an earlier time in my life, because these things don't spring, you know, they just don't spring out of my head in some polished way. I'm very assiduous in the way that I approach editing. So I think any of the cohesion that you feel in the collection stylistically really does have to do with the fact that I've brought all the stories together as a collection and worked very hard to make them feel like that they all came from the same voice at the same time.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, and it obviously reflects the fact that you're crafting them and not just throwing them out there, which I think shows that you're pretty dedicated to your work. Tell me, I guess, you know, one of the things I noticed in the review in the Economist, which I think is great that somebody there noticed your work. I think it's terrific. But there was this sort of odd statement made that it was really puzzling to see it released by a small, albeit reputable, publisher. Your publisher is Red Hen. It is a relatively small independent publisher in Los Angeles, but it's been around for a while and done a lot of books. And I guess, there's this sort of backhanded, or maybe not backhanded, but kind of suggestion that somehow the small publisher doing a good book is a surprise. And I kind of object to that, I guess, because I've been involved in independent publishing for a long time, and it seems almost ridiculous to suggest that a book published by a smaller independent publisher, is somehow less. I mean, obviously, as we know well, the budgets of smaller publishers may not be so large, but the quality of the work does not seem to be indicated by the size of the publisher.
No, I completely agree with that, David. That you, in the way that decisions are made in major publishing houses, in terms of who's accepted and who isn't, who's going to be published and who's going to be rejected, there's so many really strong writers who just can't, get through whatever those series of gates are. They close for a variety of reasons,
right,
but most of all, I think they close because the publisher doesn't think that there's any commercial potential.
Well, I think that's the key element, that there is a notion of what is commercial, which is certainly malleable and changes over time and may differ editor to editor, but there's still the drive and the need to sell books on a certain scale just because of the size of the publisher. So the decisions may not have anything to do with the quality of the work. They have to do with the quality of the work in relation to an audience. And I think that's really, that's an important fact for writers and for readers to understand, there are many, obviously, here's a good example. This is a terrific book, and published by, an independent publisher. And I recently interviewed and talked at length to Jamie Gordon. My interview with her is at writerscast.com now. Jamie wins the National Book Award, published by McPherson and Company, a 35-year-old independent publisher that is called micro by most people, because Bruce only publishes a couple of books a year.
I know, isn't that exciting?
It was great. And recently, earlier this year, a tiny publisher called Gasparo, relatively tiny, in Nova Scotia, small town in Nova Scotia, published a book called The Sentimentalists by Joanna Skibsrud, and that won the Giller Prize, which is a pretty big prize in Canada. So it's been a good year for independent publishers, and I think it may, I think there's certainly no reason to think that a book published by an independent publisher is any less, know, in many respects. I mean, and you mentioned Coffee House doing an earlier book of yours. Coffee House had a book this year nominated for the National Book Award as well. So
yeah, the I Hotel.
Right. So there's, you know, I think many. I that kind of stood out for me, and I, you know, I, it's not really the key point. The point for everyone is that the Economist is a really great magazine, and it's really terrific that they noticed My Life in Clothes. Hopefully that has gotten you some readers.
I hope so. I think, you know, that it's, that's still to be determined, because books have gone out, but how many books will come back? You know, there's the whole distribution issue that small presses have to deal with. Of course, large presses have to deal with it as well. And so it's misleading to think that, oh, the review has maybe it's generated a lot of interest from bookstores who maybe ordered some books, but then if they haven't sold them, you know, in a certain amount of time, those books would be returned.
No, I think today I would say things have changed considerably, and now a review in a magazine, whether it's a print magazine or an online magazine or a newspaper or a blog, I think is more likely to generate sales online than it is in stores, and that's partially because of the problems in distribution. It's very unlikely that if you read a review of My Life in Clothes in The Economist and go into a bookstore anywhere, that you will find that book. And but if you go online, you can always find it. And that's a real challenge, I think, to the way the book business is going to be structured in the future. But it may be, you know, it may be that, as I think you had mentioned to me before we started talking on air, that you've done a lot of marketing and PR work for this book yourself.
I have, because the small press really doesn't have the resources. They have very bright people working for them at Red Hen, but also they have a list of other books that they're putting out in the fall and in the spring. And, you know, my book can only take up so much attention from the person who is in charge of marketing there. And because the book was about clothing, I thought that we should really think about trying to attract reviews or attention from magazines or bloggers who are interested in style and fashion. So the Wall Street Journal has a styles editor, Christina Brinkley. I found out her name, and I wrote her an email and asked if she would be willing to look at a review copy of the book. And then several months later, she listed it as one of six books that the Wall Street Journal recommended for a gift.
That's fantastic. Well, I think that shows that, you know, I kind of confirm something that I believe, that is that it is important for writers to be involved in the marketing or distribution or just the noise, the kind of sound level, noise level about their own work. I think that it's increasingly important. I mean, if readers want to have a direct connection with the writer, there's a lot of talk now about books becoming social. And that is social meaning as a way of having conversations. And in a certain sense, writing is a conversation. And, you know, you are talking to readers. So it makes sense to me that if you're involved and if you do things that you can do things that no one else can do, that, in fact, it's better for you to send an email to the Wall Street Journal than it is for someone saying, I'm the PR person for XYZ Publisher. You know, that the people on the receiving end have heard plenty from PR flacks and people who are trying to promote books. They love hearing from writers.
Well, I think it goes both ways. I think having to self-promote is a difficult thing, and yet I'm the person who cares the most about this book, so I'm the obvious person to do this. But sometimes I feel like a little bit of the cat at the door, you know, just sort of scratching on the screen,
right,
and wondering if I am going to get some attention, and knowing that if the press writes or if I write, you know, we're competing for attention for books that have been published by major houses that may or may not have marketing budgets behind them, but or at least potentially have some marketing budget behind them, which, you know, in the case of a book like this, it didn't. But I recently did a reading at a dress boutique, a clothing boutique, and there's several clothing boutiques that are carrying the book. So that's some of the creative legwork that I've been able to do because of the nature of the book. And I must say, the very beautiful cover photograph by Ruth Morgan. And
it is a beautiful cover, by the way.
It's a beautiful cover. It's very wistful and evocative, and it's this old-fashioned dress form that Ruth, who's a friend of mine and an excellent photographer here in Berkeley, California, where I live, we were together when she decided to buy it as a piece of sculpture, and I said, well, maybe we can take a picture of that and suggest to the press that they use it for the cover. So,
and this looks like a desert where...
It's actually in front of the San Francisco Bay.
Oh, my God, so it's water, not...
Yeah.
I thought it might be like Lake Bonneville or someplace like that. It looks almost like a, you know, a flat expanse.
Yeah, because the water and the sky kind
right.
of mute into this monochrome.
Right, you can't really tell that it's water, but now that you say, I certainly can see it. But it's a great skyscape against the, you know, the image of the cover is, or the image of that dress form is against a beautiful sky.
Yeah.
So it is a very evocative and mysterious, too, because, you know, it kind of gets away from the more trite or mundane way of, you know, of doing an image that reflects something to do with clothes. This is much more mysterious and complex because you're underneath rather than you're not showing any clothes.
That's right. The dress form is the kind of naked version of, you know, of the body.
Right. Well, and it's also, it's got all, you know, you can see the insides, you know, you can see how it's built.
Yeah.
Which you can't do with a person. But it's great. No, I think I do think this is a book that, you know, I think a lot of people who may not identify as readers of fiction, who would not necessarily look for a book, but who are interested in the way, you know, that's why I think it makes sense for you to pursue readers outside of maybe traditional venues, because you can get people who would not necessarily know about you or even think to pick up the book.
Yeah. You know, I've been very surprised by a couple of things, by the fact that men have liked this book so much. And there's some stories really do deal with the sort of the bittersweet tones of love found, love lost, and maybe there's a certain insight that men have about women's feelings that come through in the stories. And also younger women, because the stories, the childhood stories and the teenage stories are really from such a different world. I mean, a world that is really gone and doesn't exist anymore, but that younger readers have liked the book too. So I've been very pleased that it's had It's found meaning in unexpected I guess, connections for me, and that's the most gratifying thing as a writer, is to make those connections, and when they're not exactly to the most obvious audience, but connections to people outside that. It's been good.
Yeah, I think that's great. Well, it's been really great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Summer Brenner, talking to you about My Life in Clothes, a collection of short stories. This has been Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk, your host, and thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I so appreciate it.